Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host.
Kimmy Candy.
So Lisa, how are you? How was your summer?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Good. I had fun filling in for you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I can't believe it's over.
Aww.
Now it's back to work on the show.
What a letdown.
Yeah.
Episode 130, and we are joined today with all of our regular co-hosts for the first time in like 3 months. There's Dan Quick.
Welcome to October.
Makalua.
Yes, I like October. I have a birthday.
Nice. And is it on Halloween? All right, don't say that.
No, it's Monday, actually.
And we're joined also by Phil.
My close borders are sparked passion.
We're joined by our guest, Keymade Candy. Keymad Candy.
Hi.
And also myself. And I'm not a guest. All right.
We're going to do Matthew a huge favor and not sing happy birthday to her.
Thank you.
That is your present, because we love you.
I love how anything that we could do for her is overshadowed by things that we were not going to do for her.
It's clear, true friends here.
On our first actual topic, because, you know, we try to have something to hold the show together other than our wit and good looks.
Can't tell that over the internet.
Come on. We don't want people to know how good looking we are.
Yeah, we'll get the mom to face it and be like, oh my god, it's that guy from Polycast.
Some of the topics in that thread about listening to podcasts on 29 were interesting. Like, it was mostly just discussing the AI in Civilization 5 and how they tried too hard to win. At least that seemed like the gist of it. Because they're like, well, they said that the game should have like a meta history that remembers like how peaceful you've been over a number of games. So they would like remember like how you did like the last 10 games and kind of judge you from there. Like, if you've gotten first place in the last 10 games, then they, like, then the AIs will know that you're, like, good at Civ, basically. I don't know how I feel about that, this idea.
That's just silly. Human players shouldn't even do that, because you don't know on a game-to-game basis. Not to mention, if you're playing single-player against the AI, you know, sometimes when you're playing single-player, you want to play differently. And I know it's novel, but you know, even I'm like that. You know, like, sometimes I do want to play a peaceful culture game, whereas other times I want to fire off, like, 200 nukes. There are certainly different play styles that players are quite likely to want to try out, at least. And having the AI remember you dynamically from game to game is threatening from that standpoint. But I also feel like even in the multiplayer realm, I mean, yeah, it's useful to note that somebody's a good player and that they're probably going to be more threatening than others, but at the same time, you can't let that cloud your judgment about how you go about trying to win the game. So, you know, it's really when you're looking at the Empire within the game is where you're making your decisions on whether, you know, you maybe want to hamper number one or just try to develop your own Empire, depending on which is easier to do and whatever. But just because someone played well in a previous game or even a long series of games doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to win the one that they're in. So I don't really like the AI to copy what I consider to be bad strategic behavior on the part of humans.
Yeah, I don't really like it. I mean, I don't know. He seems to also imply that, you know, it's better to have, like, an okay position over a number of games. But that was, like, one of the complaints that that we had about Civ 4's AI, because they wouldn't, because some of them would do pretty well and get a high-ish score, but not really try definitively to win the game. I mean, you would see the whole culture, but
back when JDOG 5000 was still doing heavily the better AI mod for Beyond the Sword and Civ 4, he and a couple others looked through the AI, and it's really only coded to pursue one victory condition, and even then, that's only in Beyond the Sword. where it will actively plan out a strategy to win a cultural victory. That does leave it vulnerable, but it's also the most frequent AI threat to win, the other one being space. But the AI doesn't really optimize its spaceship planning at all, so you can be significantly behind it, and then you'll beat its internet. And just because you're researching space tech while it goes off for laser or something, you can often beat an AI that's ahead of you in technology in the space race. At least in Civ 5, it kind of sort of makes an effort. But I made this argument last week. I feel like with Civ 5, they kind of shot for an in-between ground and got something that didn't really make either side happy because of it. You know, you have so many AIs in Civ 5 that still do things that are like just overtly terrible from a strategic standpoint, and it hurts their chances to win. And then you have some AIs that do try to win, and it can be a mess just based on how an AI decides to try this game or not. And just having it to the point where only sometimes is everyone in the game actually playing the game, that is a little grating. And it is a problem in both Civ 4 and Civ 5, ultimately.
Great generals, movement, and area of effect in Civilization V. Thread started by Jay Neek. I can read. I always wonder why my great generals on a horse only receive 2 moves. I suggest the following. Great general initially moves 2 with horseback riding, they move 3 and with combustion, they move 4. Balance. Area of effect should be decreased to 1, which of course right now it has a hex effect of 2 in all directions for land-based units. Gameplay. Would no longer have to wait around for your generals. How you move your general would be much more important since the area of effect is lower, making warfare more complex. We could have an AI problem here, though. And going to war with more than one general will be more common since the area effect is 1, so maybe more generals will go to war instead of turned into golden ages. And I apologize that the thread was actually started by that is 81. There is a poll attached to this thread.
Now we know why Dan picked it.
Absolutely no bearing on anything whatsoever.
Lies.
3 people think this is a good idea, 6 people think it's a bad idea, and 2 people said, I like it, but... I think if we are going to get into great general base movement increasing, then one of the advantages to the Mongolian unique unit, which is the...
Khan!
Great general which has a base unit of 5, then why would we have this particular unique unit for Mongolia anymore? The thing about area of effect should be decreased to 1. If you decrease it to 1 and then you increase your movement, I think it's just going to make your turns a little longer because you're going to have to micro them a little more to maybe move here and then move there and every which way. And he talks about having more than one great general. Sometimes if you're fighting on a couple of different fronts, like you're being aggressive on one front, you want to be defensive on another, then yes, it's helpful to have the great general. But having to have more than one in the same area because of the effect being decreased to 1 just seems to be, again, a micromanagement headache to me, and I really don't see the advantage, although I do appreciate, in part, his point about more generals going to war instead of being turned into golden ages. I mean, at some point, you know, you only need so many great generals, but I think the great general is fine the way it is. But I think the only issue with the great general, I think we've talked about this before, is how the AI right now doesn't protect them. But that's not so much of an issue with the great general, but how the AI treats them.
Yeah, the great general, I don't know that I agree with this suggestion. Also from a balance standpoint, when you, it's something that maybe wasn't considered, but when you make a change like this, you actually empower the attacker more so than the defender. And the reason that is because the great general can move and can possibly even move additional squares, call hexes, compared to now. You could attack with the unit, then move your great general, attack again, move your great general, and basically just walk down the line getting increased attack ability on each of the attackers while the defender's locked into a one hex radius area. So you offensive campaigns actually get an indirect buff from the suggested change. But this isn't really, I don't see that there's necessarily anything wrong with Great Generals per se. It does bother me a little bit that after you get your first one, you really, maybe a second for a second front, you really don't have any alternatives that are viable for them other than a Golden Age. Maybe if there were another option that would be strategically pulling against the Golden Age, something that you could do instead, then there would actually be an element of strategy in applying your Great Generals beyond your first one or two. But as it stands right now, like, I don't think that their role in combat causes too many problems. I would just like to see the players have a little bit more in terms of the strategy of using them, because for the most part, they're very easy to make use of and control. They can go over other military units, you can position them in a wide area and basically get their benefits. You really don't have to think too much with a Great General beyond just slapping one in the middle of your carpet of doom and you're good.
That takes us to, actually, I talked about multiplayer in passing, because that was intended as a backdoor segue. Yeah!
A backdoor segue. the next topic is on quitters and multiplayer. So this guy is actually talking about how he quit after getting a bad, not a bad starting position, but just a bad, just a bad game, basically. It just didn't turn out that well for him. And it's just that it was annoying that people that he was playing multiplayer with were quitting because they just weren't having fun. There was basically a monstrous AI that kind of made the game unfun for them. And is there a way to, like, keep people who are going to quit anyway out of a multiplayer game? Short of what he said. Noting names and blacklisting people who do it without any explanation. Which may prove fruitless, as so many people do it. I find the first reply funny because he's just like, yeah, this is why I keep Excel spread. You're going to have to delete this. Did you see it? Did you see it? He's not.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
Okay, like, he keeps an Excel spreadsheet with bandits.
Spreadsheet.
With abandoned
people.
And resigning, I guess.
Yeah, other than that typo, I think that's actually an important distinction between people who quit and people who resign. And to me, a definition of a quitter in a Civ game, some people talk about, well, they're in a bad situation. I'm going to even give, like, a base qualification, which is they leave the game without saying anything, whether that's voice or that's in text. Now, at the same time, someone typing, I'm leaving, 1 second, and then the next sentence, second, leaving, could also question whether or not that's someone quitting and they're just trying to save face.
This is interesting, because at what point does a loss or a losing position become a blown game? Like, I can see people quitting when they can't possibly win. And certainly, I feel there needs to be a mechanic. I guess I want to say a good manners resignation or just admitting defeat where it credits the other person with the victory, essentially. And I would like to see something like that because then it would be less grating to have someone just quit. Now, the people who are really a problem are those like Colonel Bogey says. Like, they'll join a game, you'll get in 10, 15 turns. They're certainly not out of the game yet, and they'll just quit. That's really bad. If you're looking at a long game, it can be really frustrating to lose half hour, hours, just because people are quitting, you start a new game, and they quit, start a new game again. I would like to see some kind of mechanic that shows somebody up as a known quitter, where you can resign and not be penalized for it, but if you just quit at the start like that, it does reflect poorly, and then have some sort of mechanic where you can discuss it with the rest of the players or whatever, as you will, but certainly this is a problem in multiplayer, and it's not a unique problem to Civilization V by any means.
You know, right now there are a couple of out-of-game mechanisms in the form of Civ Players League, as well as the Steam group, so this one being specifically for Civilization V, called No Quitters, which is trying to have it so that people are agreeing to, I'm going to say it's Civ Players specifically to start with, specific rules that talks about no quitting. And if you're someone who consistently quits, then you are going to get a bad reputation and your ranking is going to be affected or your labeling is going to be affected somehow. With No Quitters, it's an invite-only group So they would have to see or hear or at least have the perception that you're not someone that is going to quit. And if you do quit, then you're going to find yourself kicked out of the group. And I get the impression, good luck of ever getting back in. Some of the extremes to the no quitters, for example, I read that their rule is that you can only quit when you lose your capital city. That anything other than that or before that, you know, short of, you know, like the power goes out or a house, like your house on fire or something like that, is not an acceptable reason to quit.
How do you prove that, though? Like, here's a picture of my house that's burned down. Like, people could just take any picture.
Yes, X. But I think saying that you have to wait until your capital is taken is a bit extreme, but I get the idea of you want to be able to have, you know, a record of these things, a tally of these things, and try to build up, you know, not only the talk about, you know, reputation in terms of the negative, but you might also want to be able to do something positive, have a positive reputation as someone who, even if, you know, they're in the dire situation that they are going to stay in the game until they die, until there is no hope, or they're someone who graciously resigns at a particular point in the game and acknowledges the reason why. You've got your friends list, for example. It'd be nice if you have a game, a multiplayer game, you're randomly matched up, that from that particular list, competitors, so that it could include someone's username, because unless I remembered it or I took a screenshot or wrote it down, they have no other way of contacting these individuals again or remembering who they are. So then after the game is over, in terms of a formal mechanism here, be able to say, okay, you played this game with this person, you left, or the game ended, or whatever, then some kind of ranking in terms of, you know, they quit, or they resigned, or they stayed until the end. So that way you didn't have to strictly rely on a Civ Players or a No Quitters League, which, you know, depending upon your nature, may or may not benefit you. Like, I mean, Canuck Soldier from Civ Players says that their system works best with people competitive in nature as they care about their record. Even if we have the best system in the world, right, there's still going to be people that probably enjoy quitting, probably enjoy messing up games. If that's all they get, their jollies. And then I think the question also becomes not only how do we deal with quitters in terms of preventing it, but what should happen to the game afterwards? And some people really got into it about how it shouldn't be that the AI takes over that Civ, and some people said that's because the AI will do worse than the human player, or some people say that now the AI was going to take over and get an unfair advantage as compared to the human player, so it's going to be worse for everybody else. But if nothing else, what else would you do when someone quits? What would you have, just the Civ be completely eliminated off the map? Would you have some sort of mechanism where then it divides the cities somehow between the remaining players? I think the AI takeover is really the only practical way to go about it. I think the focus is on the prevention rather than the cure, which is trying to get people not to quit in the first place.
AIs can still screw up the game. I mean, certainly they're easier to kill, and if somebody quits early and is taken over by an AI, where, like, say you have a four-person game free-for-all, and one person quits and it's an AI, well, his neighbor can probably crush him very, very easily and early, especially if the in-game difficulty isn't set too high, whereas the rest of the players, if they're all competitive, are going to be struggling against each other and having to worry about their early defense is more, it's going to be a huge advantage for whoever's near that AI.
And for that point, I really don't see how something, a mechanism in game, can really do anything to help you. It might recommend some suggestions, but in the end, it's going to be the other human players needing to talk to each other. But I'm not really sure there's viable mechanism to put into the game other than maybe some sort of algorithm that looks at, okay, it's the first X number of turns, percentage of players that are no longer playing and AI has taken over is 50% or greater or something. Have a dialogue box that pops up and suggests perhaps you might want to restart. And, of course, have the option to disable such things if you find that annoying. But beyond that, it really comes down, again, to the human equation.
Yeah, I think the reasonable thing to do is just to tell people, like, a few times ahead of time that you need to quit. It's not like, I don't know. You can just have a little bit of self-control and wait a couple of turns while you tell them. Or, like, I don't know, if somebody's pretty close to you, they can afford it. Get some of your cities to them, if they want it, of course. If it's a free fall situation, then I don't know. I mean, does it really matter, though? I guess you could just quit and give your cities to an AI, but, like, isn't that a little bit spiteful? Like, maybe a little bit? I'm not playing this game anymore, but I still care that you don't win.
It does bother me that someone would quit and give cities over to another faction.
Well, if it were you,
I would rather all the players try to win.
If it were you, would you be more inclined to be in favor?
Sort of, but not really. Because what happens is the person receiving cities as well, at least justify there's more costs for receiving cities, but the person receiving it gets such an overwhelming advantage that it would be hard to refuse them because then they're just going to give them to somebody else. But at the same time, you know, it's a really hollow victory to win because somebody else just quit and now the game is ruined. You know, it doesn't really feel like a win. So, yes and no. It bothers me in general that people play games this way. Not just Civ, but any game. Just out of spite, they completely alter the outcome of the game without any attempt at winning themselves. That's really frustrating. And those are the people I'd really rather not play with if given a choice. I'd rather play people who are better than me 24/7 than play with people who do things like that.
Yes, because then you feel like, hey, there's a sense of progression here and purpose, and I could actually learn something from that other player. Whereas people who just end up quitting and they're kind of, you know, they're stacking the deck in favor of somebody else, you know, what's the purpose in the multiplayer? I should just play single player.
Yeah. It really turns the game more into a popularity contest than how well you played the game, which it's not so good. Not so good for the quality of gameplay.
So I think a lot of it comes down to accountability first and foremost on each individual player. That if you are going to leave a game, I'm going to use a generic term here, if you're going to leave a game, you're going to leave the game because you're quitting or because you're resigning to come back to that distinction. And as you said at the outset, Phil, there could be situations where through no fault of your own or perhaps you made some critical mistakes and now you're behind the eight ball and you see that, oh, I might be able to dig myself out of this hole, but it's going to take so long that it's not going to be worth it, so I'm going to resign, because there's nothing like, oh, you need to stay in the game until, you know, such and such a turn, or until when your capital is taken. And you're just sitting there turn after turn after turn and not having any fun. I mean, it is supposed to be about fun. But I think the responsibility also comes to people if you know a particular user is consistently someone who quits, then to report that. I'm not necessarily saying report to Steam, get their account disabled, grrr. What I mean is just so you're aware, if you choose to play with this person, then there's a considerable possibility that they are going to quit on you because this was my experience.
Sort of like a reference system.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I've never played multiplayer. Does it show up with people randomly?
No, you
join a game.
That people are running. It can be with your friends or just somebody random if you like.
Hosts can kick players from, and Civ 5 from
the lobby.
But you see their name before you start the game.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you won't be starting a game and then realize it's somebody that has quit on you before, if you're the type that remembers names, etc.
Yeah, the only limit with that is you can kick the player and they can keep coming back in at infinitum, though.
Yeah, that's not good.
So I think in that situation, then you could say, well, yes, you could set it to be a private game, but then if you set it to a private game, then you need to have specific people in mind to play, which you might have, but if you're someone who, especially, for instance, doesn't, say, want to get into the forum community and get to know some people, then it's, well, yes, I would like to eventually have private games because I'd like to just play with, like, five or six people, but you need to know who those five or six people are, and if you're always playing a private game, then how are you ever going to find those five or six people that you would actually like to play with? So it defeats the purpose. So I think with the kicking is good, but then you need to be able to say, for this game or any game that I host, this person is excluded. But once the game actually starts itself, I'm not aware on Civ 5 specifically, just because it's the thing that I'm thinking of the most at the moment, I don't think that there is a way that you can actually kick a player other than to say, okay, I'm going to rehost the game, which in and of itself has its own issues. So that would be something nice to add that would give kind of a local measure, an individual measure, some sort of control over who's in the game and who's not. Shall we resign ourselves from this topic and move on?
Well, sadly, there's always going to be jerks in whatever game you play. TDY99 started a thread called, does anyone actually use the culture slider? And this is about Civ 4, not Civ 5. He said he was playing a random Civ game and he got the Greeks. And that's what I'm thinking about. How different UDs that get a happiness bonus from using the culture slider. And he started thinking, is that ever useful in any context other than pursuing a culture victory. I would sometimes play weird culture victories where I couldn't use the slider, or I would try to build as few troops as possible and make the other people not attack me because I was nice to them. There's some argument in the thread about whether you should use the culture slider to try to take over enemy cities, or whether that is too spread out over the entire map and you should focus your efforts on individual cities.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons to use a culture slider just to, you know, take over territory or even to get a culture victory. I mean, you can use it for happiness. Well, you can use it to take over territory, although I've never actually used it for that. Just because if there's an AI pressing upon you, like, you can probably flip, like, one or two tiles at most. Yeah, I don't see the point to that. I mean, I think the biggest reason why people use it is for happiness. I mean, I know I definitely use it for that.
Yeah, same. Particularly in the mid to later game. Just because, what's the technology you need anyway in order to be able to use the culture slider?
Drama.
There you go.
Drama.
And you get theater with that, too.
Yes, and you'll want to be building a theater since it essentially doubles the impact of running the culture slider, if you're going to run the culture slider.
Yeah.
Plus, the theater itself is worth a happiness if you have the die resource, but that's only if you have the die resource. Culture slider is interesting. Obviously, for a cultural victory, you're going to be running that at 100% for your home stretch. I think that's what anyone would do in a culture win. For happiness,
happiness
in the early game to mid game is really weird. When you run the culture slider, in addition to the happiness, you are applying that percentage of each city's commerce into culture pre-multiplier as well. And I say pre-multiplier because things like free speech and Hermitage, the cathedrals, will also provide a culture multiplier. So that's how you get your culture wins. But you usually don't want to be applying your commerce into culture like that because that's commerce that could have gone into research or gold or espionage even. So you can do it for happiness, but you do pay a price in that regard. Now, a lot of people would just prefer monarchy, but if you're in a range where you've already gotten enough units in the cities and building additional units costs money, now you really have to look at, do you want to run the culture slider for happiness or use hereditary rule garrisons for happiness? And it's not an easy comparison, and a whole lot is going to depend on how much you're relying on commerce as opposed to specialists or building wealth and research, which obviously those two things don't go through the slider at all. The slider only affects commerce. So you can use it for happiness through a decent portion of the game. I got into a little bit of a fight with AJ11 this thread over using the culture slider to tank enemy cities. And I actually learned a bit. I still think that espionage is probably a better way to go on average than using a culture slider to flip enemy cities. But certainly with the right corporations and with the right multipliers, you can just use the raw culture approach to flip tiles away as well. And we even brought an old thread back into the forefront where that always peace is enabled, but you have to win conquest. That's certainly an interesting game to play. I'll be trying to get a good espionage time. Other uses of culture slider maybe is a temporary stopgap for war as well, because obviously you don't want your wars lasting more than like 10 to maybe 30 turns at most. And if you're having bad war weariness trouble, get the Colosseum, get the theater in the city. Every 20% you run gives you an additional, 3 from the buildings as well as just from like another 2 from the slider. So you're getting around 5 happiness for 20%. That's not a bad deal if you have the buildings in place, especially if you have jail and other things to reduce the war awareness. You can get rid of a lot of unhappiness in a hurry. Not sure when else you'd use it other than those times.
If you've gone down a particular technological path that doesn't take you towards, I'm trying to remember the one right now that unlocks the Emancipation Civic.
Democracy,
okay, well, that makes sense. So I would be watching your opponents to see what technologies they can research and be watching what civics they have adopted because perhaps, yes, I want to go to emancipation, but it's not particularly important for me or whatever it is I'm doing right now to get to democracy, but other people do, then that can generate unhappiness in your empire and is kind of a stopgap between, oh, darn, other people are in emancipation. I guess I should go that way, too. I mean, you don't have to, but I end up eventually doing that. But I'm usually finding myself in a situation that, oh, it's going to be like 5 or 10 turns or maybe even 15, something like that. before I'm going to be able to get democracy to switch to emancipation, then you could use the culture slider to help combat the unhappiness from that as well. But I agree that it's the war weariness, and it's, hopefully it's just a temporary thing. Like, it's not something that, well, I got to set it as of turn 150 and keep it going from, you know, now until the end of time. Is there other things that you can build as well for the unhappiness? I mean, we talk about happiness in terms of this as happy, but you can also remove unhappiness, for instance, if you were to adopt police state. That's good for, you know, for military unit production as well, but I'd rather try to build some get some additional buildings in there first, such as jail, for example. You can also look at what religions you have in your city, and either having a state religion. You know, if you have one particular religion that seems to be a common thread throughout, then you can be in that religion, and you can be building the temples as well. Or if you find that, especially in the later game, if you've got like a mosaic of religions, then you could go to free religion, which would give you plus one happy per religion in city. And also, Phil mentioned about the theater, you get plus one happy from die. Have a look at the resources that you have, because, for example, with the forge, you also have gems, gold, or silver. You can get plus one happy from them, too. And the market, plus one happy from fur, silk, and whale. And all of these things can suddenly take you from, oh, gosh, you know, I'm in trouble here with happiness, to, okay, I'm not really good, but I'm not really bad either.
Yeah, there's certainly lots of alternatives for happiness. But I think the hardest one is deciding between monarchy and drama early game. That's really, that's tough.
And if you're thinking about running specialists as well, then they could also look to the caste system, labor civic as well, where you can run unlimited artists, scientists, and merchants.
Well, food limited.
Well, yes. Still, not like, oh, I can run like 1,000, yes, unlimited asterisks. I mean.
But you mentioned caste. That's actually good for cultural win. So you run caste and pacifism and farm out a bunch of artists, which you use to bomb. That is one of the key components of a cultural win. It's not the only one, but it's very important.
Civilization 5, stealing AI settlers and city-state workers. from RPGER29, Ripperger29, do you guys feel like it is worth it to start an early quote-unquote war by stealing a neighbor AI's first settler? There seems to be long-term implications, but it really seems to help control that neighbor for a little longer than you normally would. Along the same line, do you now feel like it is now super overpowered to steal a CS worker? I'm assuming that's what SOP is referring to in this context. I never play on anything higher than Emperor anymore. The rigidity of playing on Immortal, or above, I'm assuming, was just too much for me. Stealing a city-state worker, can we say yes any more loudly? Because it's, here, yoink, this is my worker now. After I declared war, let's make peace. Okay.
Yeah, it's probably worth the hit you take diplomatically for the few AI you know at that point to work or steal a city-state. When you compare the trade-offs there, it's pretty rare, in my opinion, where you're not going to want to steal the worker.
As for an AI settler, though, take the AI settler. It doesn't become a settler for you if they're a worker. There's another means, ultimately, to get another worker. That isn't so cut and dry. I think earlier on in the game, for the most part, I think you could argue the better, similar to the not as many contacts with people, although we do know that the AI seems to know about things that happened even before they met other civs, because, you know, they always have, they have some kind of oracle all the time. Or
an oracle that tells the past?
That's what it's called. It's the worst enemy in war declaration and behavior map hack. They map hack you.
When it comes to AI, I found that actually the discussion about how you should only do this on the lower difficulty levels and not the higher difficulty levels interesting.
No way.
I don't think you'd ever make such an absolute statement like that, and I would actually think the advantage, I mean, yes, you'd need to take into account the proximity of the neighbor AI, their friendships with other AI, if there are other AI in the picture, and their ability to do something about it into account. But I would think, especially on the higher difficulty levels where the AI is getting that much more of an advantage over you by nature of the difficulty level, if you can cripple them early on by taking one of their earlier settlers, so I'm thinking still the earlier game, probably will come out ahead more often than not, but I'm only speaking up to Emperor myself.
Keep in mind, a lot of these AI jerk mongers are going to declare on you in the opening turns anyway on high levels. So if you get somebody like Alex or someone like that, I don't see a lot of downside, aside from the minor diplo hit you would get with other civs for being the first to declare war. But certainly it's a lot easier to take a settler than it is to take a city. And if you, it's also a very strong early boost. And if they're going to do to declare on you anyway, you might as well get a little something-something for your trouble when it comes to that war declaration. So I can see it, maybe not every game. If you actually have a chance of having a decent relation with your neighbor for a while, maybe you wouldn't do it. But I can definitely see merit in doing that on pretty much any difficulty.
And I think even more so in Civ 5 as compared to Civ 4.
Yeah.
That's similar because, oh, empty city in Civ 4, no problem. Mine, with one unit, but with the bombardment mechanic now in Civ 5 from cities, even more so. Don't. You can stop them from settling it.
AI escorts a settler better in Civ 4 too. They always have at least one and usually two units on the settler. So to snipe off a settler and get a worker for the deal is a little bit harder to pull off. It's stronger in Civ 5 all around.
We've gone to Civ 5 and Civ 4, back to Civ 5, and now back to Civ 4 again. Yeah.
Civ 4 once again.
Conquest? I don't know.
Little bit of one, yes. This thread is titled Deity Conquest 1190 AD, started by H.R. Oscar. This is a thread I've spent a little bit of time on myself. How did he get an 1190 AD conquest on Deity? To make a long story short, H.R. Oscar was able to build machinery and engineering in the late BCs. And in fact, he had engineering around 500 BC using two great scientists. Now, there's a couple of things you need to set it up for this to work. First of all, you can't have fishing, because if you have fishing, your great scientists will build sailing, then calendar, then compass, and you'll be able to build machinery after those things, assuming you have alphabet, mathematics, and aesthetics. But it's going to take longer, and then you'll build optics and astronomy instead of engineering. So those are major negatives. If you're fishing, it's going to be hard to execute this. And so you start without fishing, you don't research fishing, and then you need the techs, ironworking, metal casting, alphabet, mathematics, and aesthetics at minimum. That will allow your great scientists to build machinery. And obviously you don't want anything that would allow you to build paper or philosophy. You want to make sure you can't build those things. After that, he used crossbows and trebuchets with some pikes for coverage to conquer AI. Now, what interests me in this is he was able to make his early wars progress very quickly because the AI wasn't advanced yet. I think he hit the first one without longbows even, and was able to take a number of good core cities and whip additional trebuchets and crossbows, which was very useful. From then on, he just chain capitulated everybody since it was a Pangaea map, and everyone is accessible from the start of the game by land, essentially. He would gift cities back. That caught me off guard. And that's why he won conquest instead of domination. But even AIs who had well over double the requirements needed to break free, for some reason weren't breaking free, and he managed to capitulate the entire continent and win the game. It's a very impressive playthrough. For any high-level game, I don't care what else you're doing, you're going to want to have good, great person management. Dedicating a few cities to getting great people out, and then getting the technologies that allow you to gain multipliers for great people, say philosophy for pacifism or literature, build the national epic, national wonder. Those things will increase the rate at which you get great people and then increase the rate at which you can build technologies, which until you start getting diminishing returns from great people and they start costing too many great person points to get them quickly, nothing in the game can compete with the speed of that. It's very similar to the combination of research agreements in bulbs and Civ 5 in that regard. You can bulb technologies with great scientists, and you can use research agreements to get through the tech tree, especially late game. That's the same thing with bulbing in Civ 4, except for the great people tapering off means that you probably want to spend most of your bulbs fairly early game. And things like that really set you up to play a strong mid-late game. And this is just one example of how you can use your great people points to your advantage in this game.
As someone who has yet to venture really much above Monarch in Civ 4, I paid a lot of attention to the setup for some reason, even more so than some of the particulars of what happened afterwards. And I understand the disabling of tribal villages and random events because that's taking away some of either the luck and or being blindsided just by pure chance, pure luck kind of things. But I also thought about some other options that people might try to enable, maybe to a lesser extent about, you know, not having vassalization capability, which was a big thing about towards the end game of this this person's play, but also how it would change how you might go about it, generally speaking, and the viability of something like this if you were to disable technology trading. Because I got the impression that especially the technology trading helped set up in alignment with the bulbing that this person wanted to do in the order that they wanted to do it and the technologies that they did and did not acquire and when.
Totally.
It did, but it didn't. The way technology trading's influenced these games is you would get engineering later, but so would your AI opponents. And engineering is what really cuts into your trebuchet wars. Because castles, 100% defense bonus, and AI will build those castles pretty quickly. And on top of that 100% defense bonus, it reduces your bombardment rate by 75% until you get the cannons. So you're looking at, you know, if you have no promotions on your trebuchet, you fire off 4% of those defenses per turn. It takes 25 rounds of trebuchet bombardment just to clear the defenses. So if you want to take a city within a turn, you'd need more than 25 trebuchets. You would need, like, probably 15 plus just to reliably take a city on the second turn of bombardment. That's pretty crazy, especially since AIs can typically produce units every turn in a lot of their cities. You're fighting a lot more units once that engineering rolls around, and it's going to take a lot more resources in order to capture them. But at the same time, without tech trading, the AI doesn't tech trade with each other, and AIs that fall behind, especially the idiot warmongers like Shaka, like Ragnar, like Genghis Khan, those guys will get technologies very slowly then, well, in terms of deity pacing anyway, and you'll have more time to wage war. Now, this particular strategy wouldn't be viable at all with vassal states, but other applications are great people bulbing. Probably would be. Well, you could use this early without the vassals, but you wouldn't be able to end the game with it. You would just conquer a civ, maybe two civs, and then have enough land to be competitive with the AI because you managed to pull that off. But yeah, anytime you change settings, certainly it changes how you play the game. And you could win really easily on deity with consistency just by using permanent alliances, for example. It wasn't enabled here, but you could one city challenge domination win deity with permanent alliances. I don't want to say it would be easy, but you could do it with a fair bit of frequency, and you wouldn't have to be that skillful to pull it off.
So the fact that there was the ability to vassal civilizations then, that had greater impact?
If that was disabled, there's no 1190 AD conquest here. Not with medieval troops.
It would drag out.
By vassaling people, he's getting more happiness, so he could whip more with technology trades. And anybody who's your vassal is guaranteed to trade with you as if they're friendly, so they're willing to trade you any technology in the game as long as they have it and you have something to trade them to get it. And it just allows you to bring more land under the fold than you could get otherwise. Now, certainly it would still be possible to win, but instead of an 1190-80 conquest, he would have to take out maybe Bismarck and Mansa Musa on this map and then stop. And, basically retool his empire for later wars or switch victory conditions. It would be a completely different game without vassals by a wide margin. And I think even Azor Oscar would tell you so. So vassals are certainly an interesting facet of gameplay. And, you know, even to this day, I have mixed feelings about them. I wish they were coded a little better. That didn't come up in this game. But sometimes you can actually be weaker and have someone capitulate to you versus when you're stronger. Just as one example. And there's some really, really odd and wonky prerequisites to getting capitulation from somebody. For example, if you have a vassal or war ally that shares 8 tiles of border with your target is way more likely to capitulate. Like, what you need to do to get them to capitulate is much lower in terms of your power, in terms of their power can be higher, they can be stronger, and they will more readily capitulate, even even if the person bordering them is like some junk guy, like your vassal with two cities that can't possibly contribute and hasn't killed a single unit, if they have 8 tiles of border with your target, more likely to capitulate, because it goes through that is land target call in the code. It's really bad. But if you have that same two-city vassal on the opposite side, so they're not bordering them, now that's a hindrance to getting capitulation, because that two-city vassal is considered a civilization still. And basically your target will not capitulate if his power is quote-unquote above the average of all civs in the game. So your little vassal counts towards the average power, and your target will likely be stronger than him. And if he can easily make it so that the target's power is above the threshold rather than below. But then if you were bordering him, it suddenly flips the other direction. It's a really wonky code.
Congratulations to this individual on their victory, and the log that Phil looked at and then copy and pasted substantially, as he said, into Post 10 is available on the thread, so you can delve into that even more. And yes, this person did make saves available, not just their save where they won, but actually the start as well, so you can see if you can try to replicate or even better his performance. Well, I'm assuming it's a he.
Very nice game.
Yes, it's quite impressive.
Rass Jr. started a thread that I love called Civ Birthday Party Games, because his or her son wants a civilization-themed party for his 6th birthday. How cute is that? This 6-year-old boy loves civilization and wants a party for his birthday with a Civ theme. I think that's so cute.
The son probably doesn't want it referred to as cute, but I get the sentiment. Go on.
I think it's darling. What would a 6-year-old boy want? Macho? Cool? Cool is cool, okay?
Yeah, cool works.
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, cool would be fun.
They're going to play musical chairs with each chair marked with the name of a Civ, so that they're like going around the world while the music is playing, and then they have to stop when it stops and stuff. One of the moderators asked them to take pictures and post them when they're done, which I think will be cool. And Civ Cube said, "Your son is already a nerd, sir. Congrats."
Yep.
And posted some other ideas. But I just thought the whole thread was really cute. Sorry, cool. And had some fun ideas. Does anybody else have any other great ideas?
Guys, Polycast, I'm sure we can send somebody out there to do our own take on the Baba Yetu theme song. And, certainly I could arrange for props to be employed, such as the tactical nuke pop prop, or horse archer rush prop. I would be a great horse archer at a party like this. I think be good times. Good times.
I mean, now I'm just imagining, like, live roleplay Civ, you know, like, they're, like, pretending different leaders and, like, you know, decorating their cupcakes with, like, different world wonders and saying, like, hey, I own the Hagia Sophia now, like.
I'm Shaka. No, I'm Shaka this time.
I can't believe I hate the whole Great Wall.
Well, just don't give them any weapons, and I think we'll be fine. There'll be a...
Aw, no phone service?
Always
what the heck?
Well,
you need prop weapons.
Swords were purchased so that they could pretend to be barbarians and samurai.
Yes, see?
But hopefully safety precautions will be in place so that, you know, they can't hurt each other too much.
Too much.
I did.
There's an army tank pinata.
Nice. This is amazing.
I didn't even
I approve
know
completely.
I don't know. The scavenger hunt sounds kind of cool. You could go for looking for people who look like world leaders. I don't know. I think that would be fun. If there are, like, parents there, like, yeah, you look a little bit like kid, and you look a little bit like Victoria.
You look just like Catherine. Is Catherine or Civ 4 Catherine? I'm not sure over here.
I mean, really. All the moms at this party look like Boudicca. Dan says, I'll go to that party.
Boy, a 6. Come on.
Aggressive and charismatic move.
Well, I don't know. Why don't they play Pin the Bullseye on your worst enemy? Yeah, that sounds like a fun game.
No blindfolds, though, because there's worst enemy map hack, mind you. But everyone has a different worst enemy, so everyone's going for different bullseyes at the same time, see? So that's where the challenge is.
You could just do simultaneous turns.
Yeah, simultaneous turns, bullseyes, basically giant kid melee at the time.
So the show is about a month old, and we're waiting to hear back from this person whether or not the party has actually taken place, or you know whether people made him change his mind that he wasn't going to do it.
Yeah, that was their only post on Sifanatics to date.
Yeah.
You know, we must know. Give us something. Tell us something.
I don't know. Fix is a pretty young time to start playing Civ. Like, I don't think I even knew how to use a computer when I was six. I mean, this was back, you know, like, when computers weren't as common. But yeah.
Computers had not even been invented when I was six, so I don't even
Yeah, they existed, but they were not home use things. I don't know. My nephew is six. He can use a computer. I can't picture him playing Civilization very well. I could get him a Noble. He could win Noble.
You should get him a Noble. That would be really cute.
I promise I could do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I might start playing Civ when I was 13, 12, something like that.
Yeah, playing your first Civ game should be a rite of passage, you know, like tying your shoelace and...
Learning how to read and...
Yes, exactly. That's right. That's right.
First you learn how to read and then you learn how to destroy world leaders virtually. I used to play this game when I was like 10. I don't know if you ever played like Ancient Egypt or something. Was it called Ancient Egypt? No.
I don't know if you've played this game.
Well, I don't know if I played it either, no. Okay, never mind.
Don't remember the title, but have you played it? There's this game, I mean, there's a gorilla, and have you guys played that game from 10 years ago with the gorilla?
And you're, like, not supposed to die? I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? You're supposed to win?
Yeah.
High score?
You're going for that objective, you know, the objective that allows you to beat the game.
That was Pong. I remember that from when I was a kid.
Pong was an app.
No, but there's an objective.
There's an objective. Beat the other person.
Pardon me. I gotta go get my slammable out.
She's old school like that.
Speaking of old school, Polycast turns 5 this month.
Oh, wow. It's only like walking and no longer in diapers, hopefully toilet trained.
Are we going to have a party?
Noble.
We're going to have a party with the pinata.
We are celebrating with the sing-off.
No!
My favorite is Makalua.
We want to live for 5 more years.
5 more years.
sorry, this access to this thing off material is only available to the people who have donated to the show.
Oh!
So nobody then.
Yeah, that's true, but...
I demand a 100% raise.
We've been in the 5th season for a while, but it was actually on October 20th, 2006 that the series first became known to the public and the first episode was released. So, you know, it's been 5 years, 130 episodes. We're approaching 100 different guests. I think we're at about 94 right now. And 5 letters of love and 115 letters of hate later.
And how many phone calls to the wrong number?
Still only 2, unfortunately.
But they were great.
Now, everyone on this panel is or has been a regular co-host on this show. And how am I going to phrase this? Let's do it this time. Word association. What is the first word or words that come to mind when you hear the word polycast? Maggie. Now, you're thinking too much.
Why don't you let me sleep longer? That's what I said. Get up for noon on Saturday. What's with that?
All right, what about you, Phil? Word association, polycast, means...
Whoa. Oh, no, I mean... broadcasting Civ strategy.
There you go.
Wow, he's good with his marketing stuff.
Yeah, I've been training him.
I think he studied earlier.
What about you, Lisa?
what am I doing? What's going on?
What, are you channeling Imran Siddiqui right now? No, pay attention. What, when you hear the word
podcast?
Word association. You hear polycast, what do you think?
I think.
Imran Siddiqui.
Imran Siddiqui. yeah, I think polycast, I think. Well, I think civilization, and then I think that I'm a nerd. That's the first thing I think about when I do, when I think polycast. I think polycast civilization, damn, I'm a nerd.
Well, you think polycast civilization, then what was that about me? Cause I love me. What was that?
No, I said, no, I mean, sorry, I mean, darn, I'm a nerd. Yeah. Sorry, I'm friendly, I forgot about this.
Wait a minute, you're contradicting yourself a little bit. Is it that you think that you're a nerd or that you know that you're a nerd? Cause you said both.
It's like more of a dawning realization, but it happens every time I think of it.
Okay, because you do realize you've been a regular co-host for almost 2 years, so it's just dawning on you now.
What, that I'm a nerd?
Yeah.
Sometimes I forget, you know?
Oh, I mean, I could have told you that from day one.
Oh, well, thanks.
Well, wear it with pride, Lisa. Lisa, wear it with pride.
What about you, Kelly? Polycast word association means...
Girls play Civ. That's the first thing I think of.
Yes.
Well, do you know, that's the first thing I think of, too.
No. 50% estrogen. Good times.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Lisa?
Sorry, I was just muted for a second. Because I was eating all this stuff. Okay.
Wait. You're going to sing? Well, please do.
No, I...
We'll let you. It's all right.
So, back in here. There was...
That's right. No singing.
No, I was hoping Mac could make an exception if it wasn't killerized singing.
Are you saying it would be okay if Mackie wasn't here, that she would have sung it in that case?
Not even answering the question. Very good. Deflection. Well done.
Next, he still hasn't won the sing off either.
I think I'm Dan Q still. I'll have to check my wallet. But
Dank.
You know, well, I don't need to check my underwear, but I will check my wallet.
Good, you're confident in that. It's good to know that you're confident in not needing to check that.
You've been listening to episode 130, joined by Mackie.
Also, when you check your wallet, your money might be gone, just saying.
Ooh, by the transit of property, Mackie's been in my... No.
Continue the conclusion, please.
I have telekinetic powers. I didn't have to touch anything.
Test it with your mind.
Well, it's been in my brain before. I mean, it's not like that's new.
And also joined by me and team.
I'm an intern hitter, not a quitter.
Q&L.
I quit quitting. No more quitting, guys.
Didn't you just quit?
Oh, I quit quitting.
Yeah. Wait. If you quit quitting, then that's a double negative. But if you quit quitting, that's not
a triple negative.
That's a triple negative.
Any odd number, basically.
Top score.
All right, you know what? At least I can't call you Q&L anymore. Your new nickname is
Oh, QQQ.
No.
Yes. Just make it QQ. That'll be awesome.
That'll be sick.
And came back Andy.
Before I speak my ass, I want to welcome back to Lisa and thanks for learning all your thoughts of the summer. I had a good time.
Record date October 1st, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.